works is that, first of all, anyone can ask me any question at any time. If you'd like to call in and ask a question, that's kind of the point, and we will be happy to answer your questions. In the meantime, when you don't call, I have to think up questions to answer. So I'm going to do that right now. And how I'm going to do that is there are a few sites that have compiled the most asked health questions of 2017. On Google. And some of them, so there's a list from CNN, there's a list from the Daily Mail, there's a few lists, and they're all a little bit different, but there's a lot of similarities. So I'm going to pretend to be Google, and you can Google me. Instead of Googling, we're franning.
Okay.
So now we've developed a verb, to fran.
Are we franning or franneling?
I don't know the answer to that, so let's fran it.
Let's fran it.
You could also franny it.
Right.
So if you want to franny something, just ask me and I'll see if I know. I tell my patients when they come into the office that they can ask me any question that they want to. It doesn't even matter what it's about. It could be about health or it could be about something else. I probably have an opinion about it. And if I don't know, I'll find out.
I've never known you to be one with an opinion.
I don't pretend to know everything, but I know a lot of stuff. And I don't mind learning more, and I don't mind admitting when I don't know something because, you know, not knowing something is not a moment of shame. It is a moment of, and it's an opportunity to learn. So just realize that. I know people who are, like, embarrassed when they don't know stuff. And you know how the best way to find a thing out is? Ask a question. Say, hey, I don't know that. What is that? And then the other person will tell you, and then you'll know. It's really okay not to know stuff because not knowing stuff is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to learn. So,
right.
Yeah.
So you can get to know stuff.
So learn stuff.
If you need to know stuff.
I'm learning stuff all the time. And the thing is, I know how much I don't know. Actually, I don't even know how much I don't know. But I know that I don't know stuff. And so it's, you know, you have to be learning stuff all the time. I mean, if you think I'm good at what I do, it's because I'm not afraid to learn stuff and I'm not afraid to have my mind change and I'm not afraid to look at other opinions and other sides of things.
Okay.
All right.
That's great.
So I guess I have to keep talking, huh?
Yeah, I guess you kind of do. You're kind of stuck with it now.
So the first question that that is on this particular list that I'm looking at is what in the heck is the keto diet?
The what?
The keto diet. K-E-T-O.
K-E-T-O.
See, you don't care because you don't need to lose weight, like, ever.
No. Okay.
That's your issue.
It's not on my radar.
What's weight loss? Oh, I'm skinny. Oh, I feel like I'm hungry. I need to eat more. I'm not even 150 pounds. Oh.
So how does that make you feel?
Sometimes mildly annoyed, but I also, I told you last year that one of my New Year's resolutions was to accept people for how they are. But I recognize that you are as you are, and I allow that you are the person that you are. And one of the things that you are is a person who can, you know, eat a mountain of food and not gain an ounce. That's just who you are. And I accept that.
That's good.
Yeah. So it's okay with me if you just be who you are.
I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
That's okay. Good. I guess that's how we get along.
Yeah, I suppose. Because we're okay with people being who they am. Right. And and if you tried to make me not be me.
that's a slippery slope, folks.
Oh, yeah. It wouldn't go well.
No, it wouldn't go well
no,
at all.
No, because I have a hard time not being me. I gotta be me.
Right, here we come. I knew it was coming.
Okay.
I knew it was coming.
So, what is the keto diet? You want to know what it is?
Sure.
Well, remember we had that lovely man and his husband, Scott Brown. He was here a few months ago.
Okay.
He was that very sweet man from who lived in Amsterdam, who was originally from the very exotic town of Moosup.
I remember them.
Yes.
Yes.
They're very lovely people.
They were fun.
And Moosup is beautiful. I mean, it is a little hamlet tucked away in the municipality of Plainfield. But Plainfield's one of those beautiful little towns, you know, modest, but very pretty. And on the Rhode Island border. Is it right on the Rhode Island border?
It's like, pretty close.
Yeah.
It's, you know, just maybe a town. Or maybe it is, actually. It may actually... It may
have a border with Rhode Island. Yeah. Yes. Yep. Anyway, so that's where he's from. But anyway, so he was very fascinated because he had a lot of he was, you know, obese, and he decided that he wanted to lose weight. And so what he told me, what he considers himself to have done, is to have done bariatric surgery without the bariatric surgery. So the word bariatric, for those of you who don't realize, bariatric is bariatry is the study of, you know, correcting obesity in medicine. So bariatric surgery is a surgery that you get specifically to help you to lose weight and correct your obesity. And you generally have to be obese to get surgery for that. And so obese meaning that you have a BMI, a body mass index, of 30 or greater. So, and the body mass index, of course, is a relationship between weight and height. That's all it is. So you can be incredibly muscular and be overweight according to the BMI, which is why the BMI is limited as to a health. Not wrong. It's just limited as to being a health parameter. For most of my patients, unfortunately, I hate to say it, but the BMI is useful because most of my patients aren't so good about being regular about their, let's say, exercise. So the keto diet. So when they say keto, keto is short for ketogenic. And what ketogenic means is that you're producing ketones. And you're using the ketones as fuel as opposed to using sugar as a fuel. And the idea is that you get yourself in a state of ketosis so that you are burning ketones for fuel. And the idea there is that what you want to do is make yourself as fat adapted as you possibly can. What fat adapted means is that you are primarily burning fat as a fuel. And in order to get into that state of ketosis, you have a sweet spot of how much fat, carbs, and protein that you're eating. And the carb level is generally low, and you eat the highest proportion of fat. And, you know, I track my food every day. And in the app that I use, I have a pie chart of how much of my macros I'm eating. Macros meaning macronutrients, your carbohydrates, fat, and your protein. And I notice that I do eat more fat. Calorie-wise, I eat more fat than anything else, which is probably a good thing. And, you know, the kind of fat that I eat, just, you know, newsflash, I don't go to fast food. So the fat is coming from nuts and seeds. It's coming from a little bit of dairy. It's coming from coconut. It's coming from oil supplements that I take. So I take fish oil supplements and I take black cumin seed oil supplements. So my oils are coming from healthy sources. I don't think, unless, you know, there's an argument about saturated fat, whether saturated fat is bad for you or not. And I do eat some saturated fat because I am not 100% dairy free. So we do eat a bit of dairy. You know, I do notice that my highest proportion of food is my highest proportion of calories comes from fat. So that doesn't mean I'm in ketosis. I can probably do better to be in a better state of fat adaption. But how do you become fat adapted? Well, there are a couple ways to do that. So ketogenic is where you literally are eating low enough carbohydrate and high enough fat so that you have you're excreting measurable ketones. And you can measure this by excreting ketones in your urine. You can measure that. All you have to do is take a urine sample, and you can get keto sticks. And it's very simple. When I do a urine analysis in my office, when you come in and, you know, I have to do a urine analysis for your physical exam, or if you have a urinary tract infection, and I do a urine analysis at that point, there's little squares. It's very, very simple. When you're getting a urine analysis, is very, very easy. Because it's basically a semi-quantitative test. It's qualitative/quantitative test. You get a little strip and you stick it in the urine, and then these little squares change color. And so there's a little ketone square, and you can get sticks that are the whole urine analysis, and you can get sticks that are just ketones. It has just a little square that has a chemical in it that reacts in the presence of ketones. And it's semi-quantitative. In other words, the more ketones that are there, the darker in color that square will turn. And you can tell if you're in ketosis. And if you're doing the diet successfully, that square is going to turn a lovely shade of pinky purple. Basically, ketogenic diet is, like I said, you're going to be eating a lot of fat, and a decent amount of non-starchy vegetables and a decent amount of protein, but you're going to limit your protein. You're not going to need a huge amount of protein. You're going to need enough protein to meet your needs, but not huge amounts. And fat's going to be the thing that you eat the most of. And the kinds of fats, and you do eat saturated fat. You don't eat deep fried stuff, but you do eat saturated fat. So one of the foods that in the ketogenic diet, people tend to eat butter coffee or bulletproof coffee, where there's some combination of butter, preferably from grass-fed cows, and or grass-fed other animals. You could do grass-fed goat butter or grass-fed sheep butter if you want to, as well as some form of medium-chain triglycerides or MCT oil. It could be straight-up MCT oil, or it could be coconut oil, or it could even be cocoa butter. But the medium-chain triglycerides are mostly going to come from coconut oil or from directly from MCT oil. And so that's one way to get fat in. And they'll eat dairy fat, and then they'll eat other fats, your nuts and seeds and avocados and olives and things like that. So the idea is to teach your body to learn to eat fat as a fuel, and you reduce your carbohydrates to a certain level so that you're primarily burning fat as a fuel. And that's how it works. And it works for some people. It is not going to work for everyone. It's probably not going to work for someone like Ron, who is slender and doesn't have a lot of fat stores. In order to be on a ketogenic diet, you have to have fat stores, because your primary source of fuel is fat. So you have to have fat stores. So if you're like Ron over here, it's probably not a good idea to do a ketogenic diet.
Probably not.
So, and the ketogenic diet, as I said, it is not for everyone. It's for people who have some weight to lose and who have some fat body stores and don't have a makeup where they're the kind of person that needs to eat every few hours. And that you're kind of like that, aren't you?
Kinda.
Yeah. Yeah. So it would not work for you. I wouldn't recommend it to you, and I wouldn't recommend it to everyone. A corollary to that is intermittent fasting. So people who do the ketogenic diet might also incorporate intermittent fasting. Now, intermittent fasting and ketogenic are not necessarily the same thing. You can do a ketogenic diet and perform intermittent fasting or not. You can, ketogenic diet is specifically where you're eating those proportions of fat, protein, and carbohydrates to put you into ketosis, where all intermittent fasting speaks to is restricting your food eating temporally in time, other words. And there's the two methods of intermittent fasting. And I'm kind of a fan of intermittent fasting. Again, I'm not a fan of it for everyone, because what do I believe? I believe the right way for you to eat is the way that you eat that makes you happy and healthy, whoever you are.
Right.
So the diet for Ron is called the Ron diet.
Yes, it is.
The diet for Fran is called the Fran diet. The diet for you is called the you diet. It's whatever diet you eat that makes you happy and healthy. And it could be some combination of ketogenic, intermittent fasting, eating pastries on Sunday, and a big venti Starbucks on Wednesday. I don't know. You know, it's whatever it is for you that keeps you happy and healthy. So happy, and I would think that, you know, a diet that's going to make you happy and healthy, it's not going to be one or the other. If you think a diet's making you happy because you're eating whatever you want, but it's not healthy, you're not going to be happy. So you have to find that sweet spot of the diet that's going to make you happy and healthy at the same time.
Yeah.
Right. So intermittent fasting is also a big deal, and I would bet that 2018 might see an uptick in queries about intermittent fasting. And intermittent fasting, they do something similar. Even though intermittent fasting doesn't necessarily put you into ketosis, it does help you to be more fat adapted. Because when you have periods of gut rest, you can teach the body to exist on less insulin. And again, to go into fat burning, to prefer fat burning as a fuel. And in the time that you are not eating, your body will burn more fat. That's how intermittent fasting works. So the basic methods for intermittent fasting are either each day you keep your eating within an 8-hour period, and you pick the 8-hour period. And there are some studies that say you can vary the 8-hour period. There was just there was a news piece where there was a woman who lost a great deal of weight, and she did intermittent fasting, and her period of time was 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. And that worked for her, which meant that later, which makes a lot of sense because in the earlier in the day, your metabolism is higher because you have a hormonal advantage. But I can see that going two ways. So this woman, you know, when she had lots of energy, she would eat her food. And I'm not sure if she got her exercise late in the day as well. She did her eating early in the day, which means that from 2 p.m. until she got up early in the morning, she didn't eat. And then she would eat first thing in the morning, and that worked for her. Now, there are numerous of us who wake up first thing in the morning. The last thing we want to do is eat, and I'm one of them. And if that's you, my opinion is you listen to your body. And there are studies that show that not only don't you have to do the intermittent fasting at a specific time of day, you can move it. So if most of the time it works for you, so during your work week, it works for you to eat your food between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. And then you have an event on the weekend where you know you're going to go out to eat and you're going to be eating dinner at 8 o'clock. So shift it. Eat from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. that day. And that will still work. Of course, the healthier food you eat, the better off you're going to be. And there's another style of intermittent fasting that supposedly works, and that's instead of restricting your food temporally daily, is to simply restrict your food calorically twice a week. And so on those 2 days, so you pick 2 days, preferably non-consecutive. I'd recommend having as much space as possible between the 2 days. Don't do your fast 2 days in a row. So 2 days a week, you eat 500 to 600 calories, and that's it.
Yikes.
Yeah, right. You couldn't do it. It would be
I don't think I could make it.
It would be very hard for me as well. I mean, mm-hmm. On my day that I don't exercise, I tend to eat less. And even if I eat, 1,200 calories or a little over 1,200 calories that day, I'm very hungry. So I don't think I could do that one. I would be much more comfortable doing the intermittent fasting thing. But what I do is, what I tend to do is I try to delay my first meal of the day as long as I can. And, last year I noticed that by doing that, by delaying my first meal and also exercising fasted, even though I didn't have a blood sugar problem really, my hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of a level of damage to cells as a result of high blood sugar, my hemoglobin A1C went from 5.4 to 4.9. It went down 0.5 of a point, went down a huge amount into really not pre-diabetic to really, really not pre-diabetic. So it definitely does work. And the thing about intermittent fasting is you have this long period of time of gut rest. And the time of gut rest, your body gets to repair your digestive system. It gets to drop your insulin, and it gets to adapt to burning fat as a fuel. And if you then also exercise during your period of fasting, you'll do things like train yourself to burn fat as a fuel, lower your blood sugar, your average blood sugar, lower your hemoglobin A1C. And guess what? So hemoglobin A1C is a measure of the level of damage to cells as a result of high blood sugar. It's specifically what it is glycated hemoglobin. Hemoglobin being the protein in your blood that carries oxygen to all of the cells in your body. And so it's very easy to measure that protein having become glycated, because it's very easy to measure hemoglobin because we have a very simple machine that does your complete blood count, and it counts your red cells and it counts your hemoglobin, and it can tell if hemoglobin has been glycated by counting it. So it's a very easy measure to do. But there's another test that has now that's not as popular, but some labs are doing it, and it's glycated serum protein. So they're measuring other proteins that are glycated. It's not just hemoglobin, it's other ones too. And supposedly it's more sensitive and specific to measuring long-term insulin regulation. So it's kind of a neat thing. And so if you do intermittent fasting will also help your blood sugar regulation, your level of glycation. It will help you to lose fat. It will specifically help you to lower triglycerides, which is the form of fat that travels around in your blood as energy. And if your triglycerides are lower, then they can't get damaged and oxidized, so they can't damage the inside of your blood vessels. So that's ketogenic diet with its corollary, the intermittent fasting. And I am a fan of intermittent fasting for many Americans because most Americans have the thrifty gene and can stand to have their blood sugar regulation done. That's why the people who are, because we have, 70% overweight in this country and good 30 to 40% obese in this country. So most people would benefit from intermittent fasting. There are people who would not. And if you try it and you're miserable and you can't sustain it, you shouldn't do it. Because some of those diets, like, we were talking about last week, we were talking about Weight Watchers that has the flex points, that works for people. And I mean, in the end, what really works is mindful eating. But if you may find yourself incorporating principles of other things into your mindful eating. So there you go. So that was our first question. What is the keto diet? All right. So the second most Googled question was, what is CTE? So CTE is chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And what that means is, people who get their heads banged many, many times start to have some neurodegeneration in their brains, and it's bad. And so specifically, we're looking at people who play sports, who have a lot of head trauma. So we're looking at football players and soccer players. Soccer players who head the ball and football players who get, they run into each other all the time. And it can happen in other sports too. Any sport where you tend to get your head banged, or if you get your head banged repeatedly for any reason, you can get this chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And it's unfortunate. And so you get a lot of concussions. And it can cause all kinds of effects. And one of them is emotional. If it affects the sections of the brain that control, if you get, messed up in your frontal lobe, or if you get messed up in your limbic system, you can become emotionally impulsive, and your sense of reason and your sense of right and wrong can be affected. And it's because of brain damage. So, that's something that's just come into the limelight, and it's made it very concerning. And now parents are questioning whether they want their kids to play some of these sports where they get head trauma. So that's CTE. All right. So number three, what is opioid addiction? Big sigh. So first of all, let's unpack what is an opioid. Okay. So you have all these receptors in your body. They're called opioid receptors. It's an opiate. Is an extract of initially the plant that was thought of as the opiate was opium, which is why these compounds are called opiates or opioids. So an opiate is an extract of opium, or an extract that is like opium, and an opioid is something that's like an extract of opium. So sometimes the words are used interchangeably, which is fine. So you have compounds in your body that are called endorphins, and they are also opioids, and you make them in your body. And you have receptors for these opioids or endorphins in your body. And that is why you can smoke opium or take an extract of opium or a synthetic chemical that is like an extract of opium, and they will stimulate the receptors for the opioids. So you have opioid receptors all over your body because opioid pathways in your body are related to a lot of things, including pain control. So with pain control, you can have potentially pain anywhere. You also want to feel good in your brain. So you have pain and you also have pleasure. And when you have stimulation of opioid receptors, you get a reduction in pain, and you can also get an increase in pleasure, which is great. And so that's why you have these receptors all over your body. And so when you do things like challenge your body when you hurt yourself, or even if you just get exercise, and when you move around a lot, you increase opioids, because when you have inflammation, you're, in order to be able to tolerate inflammation, you have to have some opioids around to reduce pain. Because if you didn't have opioids in your body, you would be in pain all the time. People who, like, for whatever reason, they can't, they don't have any opioids, or their opioid receptors don't work, they're going to be in pain all the time. So So walking from here to there, your body's going to produce opioids, its own endorphins. So Listen to that word endorphin. Endorphin is a portmanteau of endogenous morphine. And morphine is a classic extract of the opium poppy. All right, so that's what endorphin comes from, endogenous morphine. That's where the word comes from. All right, and so you make those in your body. So opioid addiction. So why is there opioid addiction? The reason is there is a feeling in public health that it is cruel to have someone be in pain. And in the last 10 to 15 years, it has become more common to prescribe opioids or opiates to help people with their pain, whether it's codeine derivatives or fentanyl or, morphine derivatives, your Vicodin and your Oxycontin and all those different things. It's become more common to prescribe those things. And the problem is that with opioid receptors, once you take a drug, the opiates attach to those receptors, and your body will downregulate the number of receptors it has, because you're looking at it, because it's saying, oh, my opioid receptors are overstimulated, so it downregulates the number of opioid receptors. So you need more drug to stimulate the ones that you have left. So that's why you get dependency and people become addicted. The problem with opiates is they're very addictive. People really like the way they make them feel. I mean, if you don't take any opioids and you go out for a great run or you have a great workout, even if the workout hurts, and actually especially if the workout hurts, you're going to feel endorphins afterward. You're going to feel better. You're going to feel happier. Why? Because your body is going to kick out these chemicals to reduce the pain that you put yourself into, because you can't work hard without experiencing some level of pain. And the reason you can endure it in part is because of your own endorphins.
Wow, that's amazing. So there, because you have like minor muscle tears and things like that whenever you're doing something physically active.
Yes.
So that's part of managing the pain for that.
That's what you, wow. You make endorphins. Absolutely. You would not be able to exist without endorphins. And the endorphin receptors are everywhere in your body. So people feel really good when they take these things. So they become addicted to them because your body will down-regulate the number of receptors. So you need more drug to stimulate the receptors that you have left. And you keep eating more and more and more. The problem with opiates that you take is that they have a therapeutic window. The window between where you have pain relief and the window where you experience respiratory failure. Because they suppress respiration. There are opiates, there are opioid receptors everywhere in your body. They're in your digestive system too, which is why people get constipated when they take opioids. When you stimulate opioid receptors haphazardly, people get constipated. And that's why they give other drugs to stimulate other receptors or block the receptors in your digestive system specifically, so you can go to the bathroom while you're on opioids. It could be because there are opioids everywhere. If you didn't have opioids in your digestive system, it would hurt every time you had a bowel movement. Because you have lots of muscle contractions and you got to push this stuff out. So if you contract too hard around that, it could hurt. And it hurts sometimes anyway. And also, if something's wrong and you get a lot of spasm in your digestive system, you get pain. In order for you to continue with life, you have to have some opioids on board. That's how it works. And that's why these drugs are so seductive. Because when you have opioids attaching in your brain, they make you happy. They make you euphoric. So that's why. So people very easily get addicted to them. And then the thing is, they're a controlled substance. So you can only get so much from your doctor. And depending on the laws in your state, that's
right.
And if the doctors aren't talking to each other people wind up with more opioids than is safe for them.
Yeah, there's a control issue for sure.
Yes, and different states have different laws about how much you can get and how much the doctors can talk to each other. So that's why there's a crisis. So my answer that I've said before to the opioid crisis, and I don't know if this is perfect, but there's drugs you can give that are a lot safer. So if people have chronic pain, for example, you can do, believe it or not, you can use low-dose opioid antagonists like buprenorphine and naltrexone, low doses of those drugs, and they're opioid antagonists. But the reason they work is because you have glial cell irritation in the brain. And when you take opioids over time, or when you have chronic pain over time, those cells become irritated and they're calmed by low doses of opioid antagonists. So there's a reason that it works. And low-dose naltrexone and low-dose buprenorphine can reduce the inflammation that causes that pain. So that's one of the things. And the other thing is I really, really think that we have a huge, in the medical community and in this country in general and possibly in the industrialized world, I don't know how long-reaching it is, but certainly in the United States of America, we have a lack of respect for physical medicine. If people thought it was normal to get massage, because I can't tell you how many times I've heard people relating to massage therapy as sexual, because we don't touch each other in this culture. People think of massage therapy as, you know, massage parlors and being sexual, and that exists too, but they don't understand the idea of therapeutic massage. Who should get therapeutic massage, Ron?
Everyone.
Right.
Right.
Hello.
Right. It's a good thing.
Why isn't it covered by insurance? I don't know, but here's the bald spot where I tore my hair out, okay?
Right.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you put something that all it takes is a person putting their hands on another person, which is inexpensive, it gives somebody a job, and it would reduce medical costs by so much. And not just massage therapy, chiropractic. Now, chiropractic, thank goodness, is covered by insurance. Massage therapy, chiropractic, physical therapy. Now, the thing about physical therapy is great, and physical therapists are wonderful. And, you know, physical therapy varies based on the practitioner and the practice and all that stuff. But it is covered by insurance. But one of the things about physical therapy is, at least in the state of Connecticut or by a lot of insurances, you have to be approved to have physical therapy by a physician. And your insurance limits how many visits you get. And I think that's terrible because physical therapy is non-invasive. It's somebody manipulating someone else's body with their hands and with apparatus. It's not drugs. And it's so good for people. Then there's acupuncture. Acupuncture is starting to be covered by insurance more. Again, another thing that is non-invasive and can really help people, takes away pain, works directly with opioid receptors. It doesn't make sense that it isn't used more. I wish I could go to my dentist and instead of her giving me carbocaine and giving me, you know, different anesthetics, that I could have acupuncture as my nerve block instead of, because that can be done. I would much rather have that, because you put the needles in, your pain is blocked. When you're done, you take the needles out, you're done, and there's none of this, I can't go to have my coffee afterwards. Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So let me see. Did I forget any physical medicine? Massage, acupuncture, physical therapy, chiropractic, and, you know, different, and all the different esoteric body works. If a body work can be, you know, tagged into massage therapy, I think it should be covered as well. So that would mean your, you know, myofascial release and your Bowen technique and your healing touch and your Reiki and all that kind of stuff. I think that should be tagged into massage. If a massage therapist does it, it should be able to be done. And then, you know, further along the line, maybe some more, like, I think the Bowen technique is wonderful. And I think that should be covered too. It's a very gentle therapy where you're pushing on tendons at various places in the body to help people with healing. And, you know, it's sort of like acupressure, sort of not, you know, but, you know, Bowen, who was an Australian dude, he didn't know anything about acupuncture, but he found places on people's body that correlate with acupuncture points. So that would go a long way to help opioid addiction. And one of the reasons you give opiates, too, is because if you give NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, they just have too much gastrointestinal they have too much gastrointestinal issues. They cause gastrointestinal bleeding. And whether you have a COX-2 inhibitor or not, they all cause some level of gastrointestinal bleeding. And then you have your acetaminophen. And acetaminophen is not an opiate. It's also not an anti-inflammatory. It's an analgesic, which means it reduces pain. But it has a big problem because it has a lot of liver toxicity. And, you know, one of the most common reasons for people come to the ER is, you know, is acetaminophen overdose. So and certainly one of the big signs of increased liver enzymes is acetaminophen overdose. All right. So we're going to break from looking at this list to answer Chuck from Collins' question, thoughts on flu shot. I don't want to go too far into this because I've gone into it before, but my thoughts on the flu shot. So here's the thing with the flu vaccine. Now, I am not yes, everyone should have a flu shot person. And if you think that I should be drawn and quartered for that, I'm sorry. But this is but one of the things that I'm horrified by is the rage, the irrationality and the character assassination that people who even ask questions about vaccination have to suffer. And shame on you if you engage in that. All right. People are allowed to ask questions. Should you get a flu shot? The answer is maybe, just like every other pharmaceutical drug. All right. Some people should get flu shots. Maybe some people shouldn't. All right. So this is the issue. This year, we talked about the flu vaccination was thought to be about 10% effective. What that means is they didn't get the strains right. What they do when they're doing the flu vaccination is they look at what happened in Australia, which is halfway around the world. And while we're sunning ourselves in the middle of the summer, Australia is having their winter. So they look at what strains of flu are happening in Australia, and then they put into production flu vaccinations that address those strains because they figure they're going to make it their way halfway around the world, and we're going to get them because people fly and people travel, and that's how it gets here. So the vaccinations have to be in production and ready to go well before the flu season starts. If you get a flu vaccination, so why should you get a flu vaccination? The reasons to get one would be because it may work for you. That's one reason to get a flu vaccination. It may work for you. If you're not going to have a reaction to the mercury that's in it, and there is mercury, and there's thimerosal in it, it's a preservative. There's mercury in it. Are you concerned about how much mercury you get in your body? And if you're not concerned about the aluminum that's in it, another heavy metal that's in flu vaccinations, you have to understand that that's in there too. And also there's chemical adjuvants, things that stimulate the immune system to get going so it makes antibodies to the strains of the proteins that are, you know, killed strains of flu that are in the vaccination. So now, if you have, in order to respond well to the flu, you have to be a basically healthy person. You have to have a well-functioning immune system. If you have an immunodeficiency, on the one hand, it might be good to get a flu vaccination because you make antibodies to whatever flu strains are in there. On the other hand, it might not be good because it might make you sick because it'll stimulate your immune system too much. And sometimes it's not good to get vaccinations if you're immune compromised. If you're very immune compromised, it's probably a bad idea. Now, the other thing to say is that are you going to get the flu for sure if you don't get a flu vaccine? Well, no, of course not. That depends on what else is going on. You have to come in contact with the flu, and your immune system has to be down enough that it accepts the flu and your body has to fight it. And whatever you say, whatever you believe, if you are a non-believer in natural medicine, I hate to break it to you, but there are good studies on elderberry. Elderberry has been shown to kill the flu vaccination. So if you take elderberry every day, it is possible that it's going to help to prevent your flu. And if you actually catch the flu, it will help to shorten your flu if you take a lot of concentrated elderberry syrup. That's a fact. Whatever you believe about facts, because I know that there are people who argue about what facts are. Well, this study shows it doesn't work, and this study shows it does. So what's the real facts? You know, you have to pick your science. But I can assure you, if you would go into PubMed, which is the database for the National Health Institute, you will find studies that show that elderberry is effective in preventing and treating the flu. So, you know, take elderberry. It's a good thing. The other thing is, if you get a flu vaccine, you're not off the hook. Like I said, probably only 10% effective this year, which means they didn't get the strains quite right, which means even if you got the flu vaccination, you may still get the flu, not because the vaccination didn't work. The vaccination may work against whatever strains you are vaccinated against. But if the strains mutated or if some other there are other strains out there, you could still catch the flu. The vaccine won't do a thing for you. So you might as well take the elderberry anyway, because the elderberry doesn't care what strain it is. All right, the other thing to do is wash your hands, neti and gargle. Don't eat too much sugar. Neti being use a neti pot every day, maybe twice a day. Wash your hands a lot and gargle with salt water and possibly tea tree oil. And then don't eat too much sugar and get your exercise and eat your veggies. You're not off the hook, even though you get a vaccination. If you get a vaccination, you can't just walk into Flu Central and expect not to catch it. Like I said, they might not have gotten the strains right. And that's always true, that the flu, that the strains can mutate. So there you go. So I'm going to move on now because I want to get through these questions. So the next question is, what is lupus? So lupus was, and I remember on House, when we used to watch House, House would say, it's never lupus.
Right.
Well, and, you know, getting a diagnosis of lupus is hard. But we were interested in lupus because I think it was, there was a famous person last year who had it. And it might have been Selena Gomez. I think she needed a kidney transplant. Anyway, yeah, so she was a famous singer. So lupus is an autoimmune condition. And what an autoimmune means that you make antibodies to systems in your body. What that means is you can make antibodies to a lot of different things. One classic sign of lupus is you get a rash on what we call the malar surfaces of your face. And it can be a discoid rash where you get little reddish purplish discs on your face. Not everybody gets that, but you can get only discoid lupus where you don't have any other antibodies anywhere else. If you're diagnosed with lupus, you might have a rheumatologist, and depending on your antibody levels, what you usually you have a positive anti-nuclear antibody. And what was interesting to me is when we used to watch House, I remember one time they were questioning whether it could be lupus, and one of the smug residents said ANA was negative. And I just want to point out there that one of the main screens for lupus is ANA, or the anti-nuclear antibody, and it's a general screen for autoimmune conditions. It isn't always positive, even though you have a diagnosis of lupus. And then there are other antibodies that you can test. There's particularly DNA antibodies, particularly double-stranded DNA. That's a classic. And then there's lupus anticoagulant, and there's single-stranded DNA. So there's different antibodies that you test when you're suspecting somebody of lupus. And they may or may not be positive. But once somebody has a positive ANA, you're going to be monitoring them for organ stuff. Because the issue is that you can get antibodies to any organ in your body. And it could be the heart. And you're particularly concerned about the kidneys, liver, and heart. And so all of those things can suffer when you have lupus. And so if you are diagnosed, you're probably going to be under the care of a rheumatologist, and they're going to be testing your blood all the time. And they might ultimately, well, if they see any signs of anything changing, they're going to do biopsies of the organs, not the heart.
And there's no cure?
It's very difficult. It's once you have it, you have to manage it. You basically have to manage
it.
You have to reduce. You have to do things to reduce inflammation. So if you go to the rheumatologist is probably going to put you on immunosuppressive drugs, and they may be the first one they often put you on is Plaquenil or hydroxychloroquine, which is also an antimalarial drug, but it does have immunosuppressive properties. That's the first one they usually put you on, and if you are in acute flare-ups. Or as needed, they'll put you on prednisone. They'll put you on some kind of a steroid. But not always. Like ongoing, if you're in, you know, a steady state and you're not too severe, you'll probably be on Plaquenil. And they're going to be monitoring all of your antibodies and all of your organs to make sure you're not having signs of attack to those systems. We help people with natural medicine.
I was just going to ask, is there a non-pharmaceutical way of dealing with this?
So when you have an autoimmune condition, you pull out what Anna McIntosh used to say is you pull out all the naturopathic stops. So you help people. You have to have the meat good. Now, there's a big push in natural medicine of these autoimmune paleo diets. So you eat a paleo diet, and it's a diet that's basically meat, fruit, and vegetables. It's healthy protein and fruits and vegetables, with the idea that grains, beans, nuts, and seeds all have inflammatory compounds in them that you just want to get out of the diet, and dairy as well. You just take those out of the diet. People who eat that diet, I mean, it's restrictive, but it works really well. It's really helpful. So that's one thing we do. We help people with their diets, at least to get their levels of inflammation down. If they won't do the autoimmune paleo protocol, then you help them reduce their inflammation as much as they can or are willing to, because that's all you can do anyway. If people don't want to do a certain diet, you can't stop them. And then you give them anti-inflammatory stuff. You give them fish oil, you give them holy basil, give them curcumin, boswellia, depending on the person, you'll give different anti-inflammatory things, and then you treat them as they are, you treat the person for whatever is particularly going on with them. So that's what lupus is.
So how common is this?
Oh, what's the incidence of lupus? I don't know. Like the incidence of lupus in the United States. I see a lot of people with some level of autoimmunity. I'm one of them. I have slight Hashimoto's antibodies, and I have slight rheumatoid antibodies.
Right. But how many people do you see walk through your door with lupus?
That are diagnosed with lupus. That's a good question. I see people with autoimmune conditions with some frequency. I don't know if that's because of the incidence in the population or because those people are likely to walk in because they don't feel well. But once in a while, I see somebody diagnosed with lupus. It's not every day. It's not even every month. You can look up what's the incidence of lupus in the United States. I'm not sure. I don't know what that is. But I definitely see people with positive ANAs frequently and probably weekly. I do see people with autoimmunity. So I test people for autoimmunity. All right. So I want to go on to the next question now. And that's it's a fun one. And it's, what causes hiccups? That's so cute. So hiccups, what are hiccups? Hiccups are a spasm of the diaphragm. That's all they are. So you get, you'll get a muscle spasm and your muscle will twitch. And so maybe you'll get it over your eye sometimes. Like if you're stressed out, you get one over your eye. Well, hiccups are, you get that same spasm, but it's in your diaphragm. So diaphragm is this umbrella muscle that covers your abdominal organs, and it contracts when you inhale. And the reason it's there is because when you inhale, you need your organs to get out of the way so your lungs can inflate. So you have this lovely muscle, the diaphragm, that contracts and it pushes down your abdominal organs, your liver and your kidneys and your stomach and your spleen and your pancreas and all that stuff, pushes it down to make way for the lungs to inflate. And then when you breathe out, your diaphragm relaxes. Once in a while, something happens and you get a muscle spasm in your diaphragm. If you're challenging your diaphragm too much, so your diaphragm is going to contract also and be involved and move around when you're eating. So while you're eating, your diaphragm is going to be floating up and down because you're filling your stomach up and your stomach's getting bigger as it's being filled with food. And so the stomach is right there underneath the diaphragm. And so it gets nudged. So if it gets nudged too fast, too hard, you can get a muscle spasm. Also, if you drink something really cold, you'll get a muscle spasm because you get a cramp in the diaphragm. Mm-hmm. And so you'll get these spastic muscle contractions in your diaphragm. And because the diaphragm's contracting like that, you get this this reflex reaction that affects your that sends air up through your esophagus, and it sends, and you exhale forcefully, and so you get this hiccup phenomenon, and that's how it happens. And you can try to calm hiccups. I mean, the best way to calm hiccups is to simply relax, just to breathe deeply. Try to breathe really deeply and slowly so that the diaphragm can relax and expand and open up, and eventually they go away. Now, if you have hiccups that are recurrent or come all the time, it can be a sign of a neurological condition. It can also be a sign of a of digestive condition, but more often it's a neurological condition. Long time ago, I heard of a case where there was a fellow who had, you know, recurrent hiccups, and it turned out that he had neurological AIDS, and that was what was causing the hiccups. Neurological conditions can cause it. So any neurological condition, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, or ALS, that's uncommon, but it's a possibility. So if you have hiccups, that won't go away. It's a good idea to get checked out by your doctor. There were searches relating to 13 Reasons Why, which was a Netflix series focusing on suicide. So I'm not going to get into that too much right now. There's a question about why is croup worse at night? So what's croup? Oh, goodness. You know why croup is called croup? Because the medical name for it is laryngotracheobronchitis. Try saying that three times fast. So what the heck is laryngotracheobronchitis? What it is you have an inflammation in your larynx, which is your voice box. So as you can see, I just had a little cough and my larynx became mildly inflamed from it. That's why I'm suddenly slightly hoarse. And so you can get a virus that inflames your larynx, and then you get laryngitis because your vocal cords can't hit against each other to make a proper voice. And the trachea, which is the pipe that goes from your throat to your lungs, and your bronchi, which is the branching of the pipe that goes from your trachea into your lungs. So you can get inflammation there. And when you have inflammation in your larynx and your trachea and your bronchi, you're going to have a lovely resonant cough because you have inflammation there and the sound travels so nicely through that mucky tissue. And then you get this beautiful cough that sounds like a barking seal. It's just delightful. And that's croup. Yeah, I remember when my sister was a little kid, we went somewhere. Maybe it was when we went to Florida. We went to Disney World. And Nancy got her face painted like a clown. And she had asthma, or she had allergies, and she was coughing. And a lady walked by her and said, "That clown has croup." And I never forgot that. It was pretty funny. All right, so why would it be worse at night? Pretty simple, because when you lie down, your fluids pool. And so why are coughs worse at night in general? Because when you lie down, your fluids are going to pool in your throat and possibly in your lungs, and you're not as able to cough them up, and they're not as able to, you don't have as much circulation because you're still. But especially your lungs are going, fluids are going to pool downward by way of gravity. So downward is now in your throat and your lungs, as opposed to downward being, you know, downward towards the ground at where your throat is upright. You're not going to have as much drainage from your throat. So that's why it's worse at night. You lie down, the fluids are pooling in your larynx, trachea, and bronchi. And so you're going to have a worse cough. And that's why a lot of times if you sit up, you feel better and your cough gets better. There you go. Why is coconut oil bad for you? Well, there's a little presumption there that coconut oil is in fact bad for you.
This is a first.
So they wanted that. One of the Google questions is, why is coconut oil bad for you? Well, coconut oil is going to be bad for you if it's hydrogenated. It's going to be less good for you if it's been refined. But if it's virgin coconut oil and it's unrefined, it's been studied to overwhelmingly that it's good for you. And people are afraid of the saturated fats, but the saturated fats are medium chain triglycerides, which are very easily absorbed, and they're a good source of energy. And coconut oil is not known to raise cholesterol, if that's what you're worried about. People are like, oh, it has saturated fat, therefore it raises cholesterol, therefore it's bad. The thing is that coconut oil is very hard to hydrogenate. It's not hard. You can hydrogenate it, but it's very hard to burn. So that's why it's good for cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So coconut oil will not make you sick. I hate to tell you, you're going to be made much sicker by going to the fast food and buying the deep fried whatever in the whatever kind of oil than you are by virgin coconut oil. Mm-hmm. You will also be made sicker by eating way too much starch and sugar than you will ever be made by eating virgin coconut oil. So
we use a lot of it at the house.
We use a lot of it at the house, and we're healthy. We're fine. JP's that silly ginger man with the long hair, JP Sears, he did a piece on coconut oil, and he said, "I had no idea that coconut oil was so bad for you. And I've been really, really disrespectful by eating so much coconut oil and being healthy, despite how bad for you it is." It's a really funny piece. Uh-huh. You should see it. J.P.
Yeah,
Sears
I'll
is a hoot.
Look at that. I'll have to take a look. So. That's funny.
Why is apple cider vinegar good for you?
Mm.
Well, if it's apple cider vinegar, if it has the mother in it, the mother being, so what does that even mean?
I don't know. What does that mean?
All right. So if you take apples and you smush them, then they're going to ferment. And that's how you make cider. All right. So if you ferment for a little while, you get cider. If you ferment for long enough, so when you make cider, you are getting the right amount of alcohol to make it into a beverage that is tasty and fun to drink and has a little bit of alcohol in it. If you let it ferment long enough, it's going to go from alcohol. The alcohol dehydrogenase is going to break down the alcohol into acetic acid or vinegar. All right. So now you have apple cider vinegar. And so what's doing that? Probiotics from the environment and probiotics that live on the apple. So some of them are Saccharomyces boulardii. Some of them are Bifidobacteria and Acidophilus. And so guess what you get from apple cider vinegar, especially if it hasn't been strained. If it's raw organic apple cider vinegar, you're going to get probiotics from it. When you get probiotics, you get other compounds that are good for you. Acetic acid all by itself. Acetic acid and other acids that are in apple cider vinegar, like glucuronic acid, are organic acids that help to promote healthy digestion. They're antimicrobial, and they also will help to, they stimulate your digestive system so you have good peristalsis, so you have healthier digestion by doing that. The other thing is that consuming acid like that can help with acid reflux. And the way it does that is that everybody thinks that, oh, you have acid reflux because there's too much acid in your stomach. No, it's usually the other way around. There's not enough acid in your stomach. So if you, in order for your lower esophageal sphincter, the muscle that is at the bottom of your esophagus, in order for it to close tightly, you have to have a low pH in your stomach, which means a high amount of hydrochloric acid. If your hydrochloric acid level is not high enough, that sphincter won't close all the way. So what some people do is they'll drink a little bit of apple cider vinegar, preferably in a little bit of water. But if you drink a little bit of apple cider vinegar, it'll go into your stomach and their heartburn will go away right away. Why? Because you're raising the level of acid that is lowering the pH in the stomach, and that lower esophageal sphincter will seal off. So you're no longer getting reflux. You're not getting, so when you feel heartburn, what's going on is you're getting sloshing of whatever's in there. And some of it sloshes past that lower esophageal sphincter into the esophagus, and that hurts. And so if you can avoid that, you know, if you put the apple cider vinegar in there, it'll close off. The other thing is there's blood sugar regulation issues with apple cider vinegar. It can help with blood sugar regulation. That's one of the things that you see. I am not entirely sure of the mechanism of action. Apple cider vinegar, vinegar and blood sugar, that people who do it for to regulate their blood sugar, there no doubt there is a mechanism of action for that. It's definitely been studied where people do apple cider vinegar and it helps to regulate their blood sugar. And in terms of there was actually a study done at the University of Arizona. And so here's what it says. The postprandial benefits have been found before. It was thought that maybe vinegar slows the absorption of carbohydrate into the blood or slow the breakdown of starches into sugars. It actually helps more in people who are insulin resistant. There's actually an effect of vinegar that it helps improve insulin sensitivity. And if you take vinegar at bedtime, it will reduce your fasting glucose in the morning. So it might promote insulin production. So it actually has some mechanisms of action that are similar to some of the drugs that are out there. And some people have reduced hemoglobin A1C as well. All right, so that's most of the questions. So apple cider vinegar can help with blood sugar regulation. It can help with acid reflux. It can help with digestion. And it can help with, it's antimicrobial as well. It'll kill viruses and bacteria and bad stuff in your digestive system. The last question on this list is, why can't I orgasm during intercourse? So let's talk about that next week. All right.
Okay.
So you're listening
Sounds
to...
Good. It's a great note to leave on.
I know. Mm. You're listening to Radio Naturopath here on WHUS, 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. This is the call and talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can call us anytime at 860-486-9487. You can also email me at any time at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, check out our podcast at whus.org. Go to the talk header and click on Radio Naturopath. You can also check out my Facebook page, Fran Storch, ND, Naturopathic Physician, Radio Naturopath, and I'm also on Twitter and Instagram, at Fran Storch, ND. We'll be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.